The Get This podcast is brought to you by ProPhotoGo.com, professional photography on demand. Use coupon code GETTHIS to get 10% off your professional photo session. So whether you need new headshots, or you have a big event coming up, an engagement, a wedding, you name it, or let's say you just want new photos so you can look snazzy on social media, ProPhotoGo is professional photography on demand. Use coupon code GETTHIS and get 10% off. Go to ProPhotoGo.com. The Get This podcast is also brought to you by WP Engine, the best WordPress hosting available. People who know me know I build enterprise-level WordPress websites that reach millions of people a year. And it's important that those sites live at a host that is secure, fast, and offers the kind of support you need 24/7. And I can't recommend WP Engine enough. I use them exclusively and recommend them to all of my clients. Get 10% off your first year of exceptional hosting for your WordPress website. Go to getthispodcast.com/WordPress, and that will trigger the 10% off coupon. Again, it's getthispodcast.com/WordPress. Hey everybody, this is Kevin Kautzman with the podcast Get This, the show about things people love, and I'm joined tonight by a very special guest, my mate, my old buddy, Brad Kelly, coming from Michigan. How are you, Brad?
What's going on, man?
Not a lot. New digs from the last time we've talked in this format.
Yeah.
Tuesday. I'm living like practically on a golf course now. This is a gross point. It's ridiculous over here.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's not bad. It's not a complaint. It's just weird for me.
Yeah. I was saying Tuesday, May 21st, and I'm in New York City. Brad's in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, right? On a golf course, apparently.
Very close to a, like surprisingly close to a golf course. Yeah.
Can you hear the golfers golfing?
No, but on my drive home, I occasionally see golf balls on the street.
That's where they belong. It's better that than like in your windshield,
right?
Coming down, raining, yeah, like hail.
No, you don't want that.
Big
want that to happen.
Honking chunks of hail. Yeah. All right. What are we talking about tonight, Brad? So the show is about things people love. I ask every guest to come on and tell me something they want to discuss. Could be a book, it could be a movie, it could be both.
Yeah, I suggested, and I sort of did this, it's hard to choose those kinds of things, but I just decided to pick as quickly as I could, No Country for Old Men.
Right. So
book
you
and movie.
Ah. So yeah. That's what I was sort of saying. So you flipped a coin.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, it's just like the first thing that came to mind. So, but you know, it's a good book. You know, it's a good book. It's one of the best movies, I would say.
Mm.
Like, nothing wrong with the book per se, but the film, I think, shit, is probably the best thing made since I've been an adult, or very much close to the top. So, you know, our favorite Minnesota brothers, besides the Kautzmans.
We're from North Dakota. I don't think Minnesota owns us that much. You
North
know?
Dakota isn't North Dakota a suburb of Minnesota?
Okay, all right, slow down.
No, but you know, Coen Brothers film. You know, they've made a lot of great movies, and there's certainly a debate to be had about whether or not No Country for Old Men is their best. You know, as I get older, I'm less and less interested in superlatives. I don't know if you can ever say anything is the best, but it certainly had an effect on me. You know, it was one of the few movies that I went to see twice when it was out in theaters. First time just had me at the edge of my freaking seat. And I remember I went with a handful of people that ended up being pretty good friends of mine in Boise, Idaho, but who I didn't know all that well at the time. and, you know, kind of hipster dudes, and, you know, maybe not guys that were that much into, you know, didn't necessarily read, or, you know, were into more sort of like hardcore rock music kind of culture, you know, scene kids.
Sure.
And I remember being halfway through and being like, man, they're going to think this movie sucks. I was gripped, but I was like, I think they're going to think this sucks. And at the end, we all just kind of looked at each other like wide eyed, like, oh my God, I can't.
What did they just
tell everybody's heart?
Yeah. Dude.
You could tell everybody's heart had been in their throat for like the whole thing. And I've always been fascinated with the, like, the burn of suspense that runs through the whole thing. There's no like real cheap suspense in it, because there's like a very, you know, as a writer, there are ways to develop suspense that are, I don't even necessarily mean cheap, but there's like a classic action film way of making suspense work, right? Where it's like you've got the ticking clock is not a metaphor. It's like a whole bunch of things have to tie together at the exact right moment. It doesn't seem like it's going to happen, and then in the last second it finally does. No Country for Old Men is just like this slowly rising fever for 2 hours.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. The ticking clock is America. The ticking clock is the Vietnam War. In the background.
Right.
It's a Vietnam War film.
It is. Yeah.
In its own right.
Mm-hmm, and it's a Western, mm-hmm. And it's a, like a gangster movie.
It's kind of Rambo in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've definitely thought about this interpretation you're talking about with the Vietnam thing. And it's only really mentioned kind of once that he's a Vietnam vet, one of the three main characters, Llewellyn Moss, was a Vietnam vet, served two tours, as we see in the film, he tells the border agent. And
yeah, let's say spoilers. If you've seen it, or if you've not seen it, rather, we're just going to talk about this film for the duration of this podcast. Not the duration, but for a hefty chunk of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, no, there's definitely this thing of like, he's a Vietnam vet. He's a welder. We learn that he's a very skilled welder. And I'm not remembering now if this is clear in the movie, but I know it's clear in the book that at the moment he's unemployed. During the course of the film, he actually has lost his job for whatever reason.
Sure.
You know, he's living in a trailer in, you know, bumfuck Texas, basically.
Right.
And you see that he has found a way to actually apply some of the skills that America has given him.
Well, he's out hunting. You get the impression he's out hunting probably to eat.
Right. Yeah, probably. I mean, it would be your unemployed dude living in Texas and you shoot down an antelope or whatever it was that he was hunting. That's, that's a few months worth of dinner.
Something.
So, yeah. 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 And there's a lot of things that, I mean, talk about him being out there hunting. There's a lot of things. You go right back to that first moment you see him and he shoots, I don't know, I think it's an antelope, I want to say.
Yeah, something. I mean, it's a...
Yeah. There's this real nice moment, and I was watching this movie a few months ago with my girlfriend, and she's, you know, she enjoys movies, but sometimes I'll give her the insider sort of writer scoop. Like I explained to her what a MacGuffin was the other day, you know?
Oh, right.
Just things like that. Just
maybe
like,
you can explain it to me. Well, you can't drop that on a podcast and not give your explanation.
Yeah. Well, okay. The MacGuffin is, and correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm interpreting this wrong, but like the MacGuffin is essentially, it's usually an object of some kind.
They only serve until 11.
What's that? That's why Taco Bell stock is going up, because they'll serve that MacGuffin all day long.
It's that egg all MacGuffin.
Egg MacGuffin. That's pretty funny.
Is that a show title already?
That is a show title. Right. That's pretty fucking great.
Yeah. All right. Well, but you were saying.
The MacGuffin is the thing in a movie that basically all of the characters are willing to do anything to get their hands on, the bad guys and the good guys.
But it's ultimately meaningless. The thing itself is, it's like a, well, maybe or maybe not. It depends on the film. But
I think it depends on the genre. I mean, most of the time in like a crime movie, it's just money.
Right.
You know, it's a big bunch of money, which it is in No Country for Old Men as well.
A good example would be the famous briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Great MacGuffin.
Yeah.
intentionally yeah, and, made just to be.
Yeah, and the name, right, and that was his sort of Pomo touch, was that nobody really, wasn't even clear what was in the MacGuffin. You know, it wasn't money, it was some sort of radiant, eminent thing. But like another example would be, we watched Infinity War not that long ago, the Avengers movie, and there's 5 MacGuffins in Infinity War, because he's trying to collect all of these stones, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, whatever. Mm-hmm. The MacGuffin's actually named after a model of briefcase.
Right, it comes from Hitchcock, right?
Yeah, but there was a briefcase you could buy at the time, what was called like the MacGuffin.
Perfect.
and then they used that in I believe a Hitchcock movie, and so it became a MacGuffin.
The MacGuffin. Great. So you were talking to your girlfriend, you were watching No Country, and you explained the MacGuffin.
Explain the MacGuffin, and then the other thing we talked about was there's this moment where Llewellyn Moss, very early in the movie, you see him, he shoots this antelope. And then one of his first actions after that is he picks the shell casing up off the ground and puts it in his shirt pocket. And it's this little nod. Like, a lot of movies will introduce a character and they'll tell you they're the good guy by they save an orphan or something grand.
Right.
This is just a subtle little etiquette gesture that suggests that he's at least got some kind of ethical structure that he lives by.
Completely agree. A little more than that is that as a good hunter, he wounds the animal.
Yes. Yeah. He's dissatisfied with that. Yeah. He's not happy about that.
Despite the fact that he shouldn't go after it for his own sake, he goes after the animal. So it's this sublime irony. It's like a character nod. It's like, he's killing the thing, but it's this thing. It's like the Rogan stuff where he's always talking about ethical hunters. So this guy is ethical on some level.
He is. And it's also, I think, comes about when his ethical standpoint is what ultimately gets him in the most trouble, really. Right. That's where they really get on his case, right? Is because he ends up going back, to give water to that guy that he found in the truck who was sort of mortally wounded.
In one reading of it, you could also read, and I'm just having this idea as we talk, you could also read that he's conflicted and he knows there's something. He goes back and he gives the man water. So we're attached to him. It's, he's obviously the hero. It's a save the cat moment. But he's ultimo hombre, right?
Yeah.
Where's the last man? There had to be somebody. So he knows.
There's some loose end to it. Yeah. Yeah. And the interesting thing.
He's not a white knight.
Yeah, that's true. He's not a white knight. And there's an interesting thing, too, about the fact that if you really think about the plot of it, if he didn't go back, they would have found him anyway because of the transponder and the briefcase.
Oh, right. Of course.
So he doesn't, from a plot standpoint, in terms of like Anton Chigurh and all that getting on his case, he doesn't even actually have to go back.
You're actually right. You're right. I had forgotten that he, of course, I hadn't rewatched it since you said we were going to discuss it. But of course, you're right. Yeah. He has the briefcase. He goes back. Well, that's a good question. So why do you think he goes back? Is he objectively good? Is it just purity? Is he trying to clean up the mess? Why does he go back?
I thought of it as him. I thought of it that as being, it's like, okay, so in a way you could think, and I've never thought this before, but now I'm trying to understand it, there's like some way in which it inverts the typical tragedy. The tragedy is you have some kind of like hero and they have a flaw, right? That is, some kind of vice or some kind of weakness that they can't necessarily overcome. Now you've got Llewellyn Moss, who's trying to be, he's essentially entering this criminal world, and his tragic flaw is that he's actually fundamentally a decent guy.
Right.
So he can't actually operate very well in that world, which, Sheriff Ed Tom Bell is totally aware of this. Like, he, from the get go, he doesn't think Llewellyn Moss is like an actual criminal.
That's true. I think this is all in play, though, because when he goes back, getting even back to my original sort of misconception, I think there is a kernel of truth around it. potentially, or at least something interesting to discuss. He comes back and he asks, he doesn't just give the guy water. He's asking, where's the last man? There's always a last man. Yeah. And it's so great because through action, we're beginning to understand this is a man who's been in a firefight before. Mm-hmm. This is a man who sees seen it. Yeah. Where would he have seen it? Well, we're going to figure it out eventually. Nom or whatever. And and so why in that moment, why does he want to know? Is it for his own safety, or is it because what is he really after in that moment? It's so interesting.
Yeah, that is weird that he does go and track that guy down. It's like he knows.
That's where he gets the briefcase.
Right. So that's the same day.
He gets the briefcase
earlier in the day.
Yeah. So again, so rewinding, my original idea, I think, is correct. He gets the briefcase from the last guy, right?
Right. Yeah.
He
pieced together that there was something missing. And I do remember him looking in the back of the truck and there being heroin there. But he was actually looking for the money.
I think that's, you know, again, this isn't a contest, but it's like, okay, so did he go back for the money? Did he have some idea that there was something? This could be his lotto ticket. So it's a troubled character. And that setup is so cool.
Yeah. There's cool things they do in characterization too, you know, where you one thing I'm really fascinated with about that movie is this, like, the way in which it shows, and Cormac McCarthy does this in his writing all the time, the way in which he shows character and competency through just, like, people just, they just, this sounds kind of silly when it comes out of my mouth, but he just shows people doing things, and the explanation is very, very minimal. So, for instance, there is this scene where Llewellyn Moss is following. He's trying to find the guy with the money, and he sees somebody sitting under the tree. So what does he do? He squats down. He watches him. He looks at his watch, and he waits for some amount of time to go by while he's just watching the guy from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moves in. There's no explanation. He doesn't have somebody he's talking to. He says, oh, we're going to watch this guy. We're going to wait. Just that, does it.
I'm reconstructing the beats of this. So he goes, he sees the scene. Mm-hmm. Is there a guy? So there's a guy in the truck. This is actually an interesting exercise.
Yeah. So when he first sees the scene, when he first comes across the scene where there's all the trucks and everybody's been shot, that's when he sees the guy in the truck who's still alive but has been, like, mortally wounded, right?
Right, and he says, ultimo hombre, agua, agua. And then he tracks the guy to this tree.
Right, who died. You know, he had managed to get away some distance and then died under the tree with all the money.
Of course.
So then Llewellyn gets the money and goes home.
Mm.
And then in the middle of the night, he wakes up and goes back out there to give that guy water. And that guy is now dead. Right. And then you get one of the greatest single shot scenes, I think, ever, which is Llewellyn Moss running across the fucking desert as the sun is coming up, as lightning is striking, getting shot, falling down into a ravine, running into a river, swimming across the river, being chased by a pit bull, getting out of the water just in the nick of time, taking out his gun, blowing in the chamber, racking one round, and shooting the dog as it jumps on it.
It's not one shot, is it?
It's like a sequence.
The run
is one shot.
Yeah.
Until he hits the ravine, but I'm not a cinematographer, but I can imagine, as a cinematographer, you capturing a perfect shot as the sun is rising and lightning is striking.
Wow.
But that has got to just give you a fucking boner.
right. Yeah. Wow, I love this. I'm really glad that we reconstructed it because my memory is a little foggy, but I love this film.
I watched it like a kid watches, I don't know, what do kids watch now? You know, when you were a kid, you used to watch the same movie like every other week. Do you remember that?
Well, Jaws was mine, man.
I was very
troubled. I was afraid to get in the bathtub.
You know what's funny is we were talking about that. My girlfriend and I were talking about that, like, at some point. I feel like a few other people were talking about what movies we watched over and over as a kid.
Mm.
And this is kind of fucked up, but all I could remember was RoboCop and Die Hard.
Probably explains your haircut. Just bald, shaved head. Never gets old. It's great radio. Talking about are at Kelly's shaved dome. Well, so so many things come to mind. Why then? Let's speculate. Why does he go back? Is it and I think this gets into the concept of him being a Vietnam veteran and a good character fundamentally.
Right.
But he goes back. He brings water back. He even says, damn it. He's only like fixing to get
killed. Yeah, I'm going to about to do something dumber in hell, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I always read it as a general moral compulsion, because he already had the money at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a little bit of a simple reading. But, you know, there is something that's interesting that this and a couple other moments show that Llewellyn Moss is this guy who kind of operates on like instinct. There's always there's subconscious drives that are mostly driving him. So he wakes up in the middle of the night and goes, okay. And then he goes and does it. Later on in the movie, when he's been sort of almost caught a couple times by Anton Chigurh and the other guys, right? Like he thought he had gotten away and he's in this hotel room and they kind of catch him. And then there's another time where he almost gets caught and he's like, it doesn't make any sense because he's been driving back roads of Texas going all over the place. And he wakes up in the middle of the night and he goes, oh, okay. And he starts going through the money.
Right.
And
that's when he's operating on some subconscious, instinctive plane.
There's definitely stuff going on in the background for sure.
They create this situation where you rooting for him as the hero, you say, don't do that. What are you doing?
Right.
Get out of the water.
Yeah.
Don't go on the boat. It's that irony where you play the audience kind of both ways.
Right. And you know, the thing is, it's like, you wonder in this, it's sort of like, well, why do we want him to have the money more than anybody else?
You know? It's
really like from a totally rational
because he's
standpoint.
Willing to, I mean, in that moment, that great save the cat moment where he goes back and brings the water to the guy, and it's the antelope and everything. And he's a good guy. So you want him to have it, but in a way there's this inevitability to it that has the ring of tragedy.
Right.
And in a way, you know, he knows he probably ought not have it.
Yeah. I mean, he gets in over his head and then he just keeps
going quickly.
And it does end up taking this sort of egotistical turn toward the end. Later on down the road, he has a confrontation with Anton Chigurh, who's one of the great villains in movie history, in my opinion. And he gets shot up and he ends up in this Mexican hospital. And Anton Chigurh calls him and says, you better come see me. And, you know, he says, I can spare your wife's life, but I can't spare. Anton Chigurh says, if I can spare your wife's life, I can't spare your life. That's the best that I can do. And Llewellyn Moss is like, you're not going to have to, you know, he's like, I'm going to make you a special project. He's enraged by this. Yeah. And he's like going to win, in quotes, you know, but it's, you know, and then the fucking irony is that Anton Chigurh doesn't even get Llewellyn Moss in the end. It's the other Mexicans that do.
Right. There's when you analyze it with the Vietnam lens on. It's one of the great Vietnam War films.
For sure.
It's Rambo. It's the guy who comes home and is living out this trauma that we sort of put on another country.
Right.
You know, speculatively, but
well, you can't. It's really hard to tell a heroic story. It's difficult to tell a heroic story about American combatants in Vietnam. Actually there on the scene. It's kind of sticky.
Especially
now. Yeah. So the only way to tell that story is to tell the story of these guys when they come back, for sure.
What, and this is a question that I've had in mind all day knowing we were going to talk about this. What the hell is this film actually about? So putting the Vietnam angle aside, what is this actually about? Why is it, why is the book called No Country for Old Men?
Yeah. No, No Country for Old Men, I believe, comes from, is it a Yeats poem?
Maybe.
Maybe. It's that poem that's slouching toward Bethlehem, ever in the turning and turning in the ever widening gyre. The center cannot hold that poem. I believe it says "No country for old men" somewhere in that poem.
Mm, I did not know that. Sailing to Byzantium, Yeats. It's always Yeats.
Yeah, yeah,
mm.
Yeah. Crazy occult, like, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, the "No country for old men." Well, part of the narrative, and you know, the character that is easy to forget because he doesn't seem. He's almost doesn't matter from a plot standpoint is the sheriff. He's clearly the third hand in the story, but like if you actually look at the plot, it doesn't matter if Sheriff Ed Tom is in the movie or not.
Mm.
Nothing. He doesn't actually impact what happens to with Anton or what happens with Llewellyn Moss almost at all. But he's the old man, you know. The opening thing is him talking about this kid he sent to the electric chair. He's talking about the old sheriffs that he used to know that sometimes they didn't even carry guns.
Yeah.
You know, and then later. Yeah.
The impotence of narration in the face of this primal evil.
Yeah.
Which is inscrutable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing that he doesn't know. You know, one of the great scenes, possibly. Maybe the best scene that you could just take out and it could be its own short film by itself, doesn't need the rest of the movie, and it's just fucking great, is, I don't know if you remember, near the end when this is Tommy Lee Jones' character, when he goes to see, it's like his cousin or something like that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the old man in the trailer way out in the middle of nowhere.
Right, right.
Had coffee on the pot for 4 days.
Yeah, and he's got a bunch of cats and he doesn't know how many, you know.
Lost count. And then he talks about Tommy Lee Jones' father, that character, I think.
His father, his grandfather, somebody in their lineage who got shot by some marauders or something like that. And, you know, he's trying to explain to him that, like, nothing's actually changed. This is all the story of this part of the world, sort of. Like, everybody's always getting shot on their front porch. which is an interesting, you know, obviously it's kind of a cynical theme, but it reminds me of this. So Cormac McCarthy has not done a lot of interviews, but there is a quote, I should look it up because it's fucking good. There's a quote from this Cormac McCarthy interview that he did like in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to try to not use my clicky keyboard.
Yeah,
to
you
radio.
Find that, and I'm going to read the first stanza of Sailing to Byzantium by who's this guy? William Butler Yeats? Some poet from Ireland.
Some poet dude, I don't know.
And he says, "That is no country for old men, the young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song, the salmon falls, the mackerel crowded seas, fish, flesh, or fowl, commend all summer long. Whatever is begotten, born, and dies, caught in that sensual music, all neglect. Monuments of unaging intellect." Interesting. Yeah, that is no country for old men. Right. Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So
here's a quote that that scene with his cousin or whoever it was reminds me of from this Cormac McCarthy interview. This was back when he, near the time of Blood Meridian coming out. And he says, Cormac McCarthy says, "There's no such thing as life without bloodshed. I think the notion that the species can be improved in some way, that everyone could live in harmony, is a really dangerous idea. Those who are afflicted with this notion are the first ones to give up their souls, their freedom. Your desire that it be that way will enslave you and make your life vacuous."
Whoa.
So that's interesting, right? Because like you generally think of like... I think the deep, when you don't think about it too carefully, a lot of art is sort of interested in this, like, you're telling the narrative arc, you're telling your little piece of the narrative arc of humanity or something. Like, there's generally a progressive trend to it. And Cormac McCarthy is just saying, no, there is no progressive trend to it. This is what human beings are. I think he leans pretty significantly more pessimistic than necessary, but there is something to that, right? Like there are ways in which, with the advent of like better communications technology and better, you know, healthcare and whatever, that we've gotten better. But then you like look at the nature of like discourse, or I hate that word, but you look at like the nature of discourse now, and it's hard to say that we've actually gotten any better in some ways. You know, people are still just as much looking for a fight, just as much looking for like drama and attention and a little violence, though that is increasingly metaphorical, you know. So I don't know. Maybe he has a point.
Yeah, I don't know either. As long as we all come into the world the same way or in a more or less similar way, and we all exit in the same way, finally.
Yeah.
That essential humanity won't change.
This is what I think is the part that's interesting about it, is he says your desire that it be that way will enslave you.
Right.
So it's almost not that he's saying like, yeah, I mean, it's not that he's saying harmony, living in harmony is stupid. It's that he's saying like, you're going against it, it will kind of ruin your life in sort of unexpected ways.
I read it politically to mean you'll look for a savior outside of yourself. You'll look for a thing to either hide in or to take away the pain of that harsh reality from you.
Right.
So this is a fundamental, I agree with this philosophy. There is something to be said about staring into the intensity of the darkness, quote unquote, of the situation and wrestling some kind of power from it by facing it.
And conquering
your fear and not saying, oh, the police will be there when I need it. Now, of course, we respect them. But, you know, you want the plan if something went down, right?
Yeah.
No disrespect, but there's this philosophical kind of need to handle yourself.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we all fall like somewhere different on the spectrum with that. And one thing that has bothered me, increasingly bothers me over time, is whenever anybody just wants to make legislation to address things about human nature.
Right.
You know, where it's like, this is what people do, so let's make a law about it. And you're like, sometimes that's going to work, and sometimes that's not going to, like, that's just not going to work. And, you know, I'm not the arbiter of figuring out when it's going to work and when it's not, but, you know. There's always, and we don't have to talk about a specific issue, but there's always something that happens in the news, and then somebody is like, we need to make a law about that.
Right. Well, that's their, like, that's a church. The state and government for a lot of people is a church. It's the answer. Oh, they're right. We're abortions and we don't like abortions. Let's make a law.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like, I'm going to wade into that. There's so much in his writing. It's interesting because, a thought that came to my mind is it's an anti-utopian idea.
Mm-hmm.
There's no utopia. You're a person. The people around you are all people, your parents, your siblings, your family, your colleagues, everyone you know is subject to this bloody reality of life. Mm-hmm. And, The seeking for an escape from that is, as he says, is what potentially enslaves you. Well, and then there's the other side of that. He's such an interesting writer. When they sold No Country to Old Men, the rights to it, the Hollywood Journalers or whatever it is, somebody recorded it saying, in what surely will be the easiest novel to film adaptation of all time, No Country for Old Men was sold to the Coen brothers, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And of course, leave it to the Coens to make this thing that is, it began as a film, if I'm not mistaken, the novel.
I think he tried to write it as a screenplay originally and I think that's
and
my
then
understanding.
Convert it into a novel. So it's not surprising that it became this masterpiece and yet in the hands of lesser directors,
Oh, you could. I mean, this could have been a schlock fest. Like, yeah, yeah. Any, I mean, I guess any basic material could be. You got fantastic acting performances. You know, everything about it, in my opinion, is like exactly what it should be.
It is like, yeah, you nailed it. What is it? What is it about it though? I think about the palette when I think about it.
Yeah, the colors are great. The humor, honestly, I feel like the humor is easily overlooked. It's really fucking funny in really subtle ways, you know. Most of that coming from Tommy Lee Jones' character, who's just like deadpan and dry and has these list like quotables that ring through my head every now and then, you know, just...
He has his goofy deputy who... Yeah. And you do not for a minute doubt his Texas accent.
Yeah.
He's the real deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
he's really from Texas.
Yeah. 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 Oh, no, it's fantastically done. Yeah. The humor, it's funnier than you actually think. The acting is all fantastic. I mean, and you think of some of the other people who were in it, they play bit parts. Woody Harrelson has a fantastic bit part in it.
Great turn.
Steven Root has a little tiny little bit that he plays in it. He's fantastic. I feel like there's another one that I'm missing, but I think, yeah, it's a lot of it is the acting. I mean, Javier Bardem is...
Yeah, wins the Oscar for a part where...
Yeah, barely any lines.
Just mental.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty.
And when
pretty...
you look at that on paper, do you think your agent passes that to you? Your manager say this is the part for you. The Coens want to, of course, the Coens want to work with you. Blah blah blah. Or I don't know how that process went, but we're going to audition you for this, and it's just a case where on paper, do you think I'm going to win an Oscar playing this part? I don't think necessarily.
No, I don't think so. It's too. The whole thing is because I mean, you win Oscars for like. It's not a film that's pulling super hard at your heartstrings, you know, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah. It's not we need somebody in this movie who knows how to cry on, you know, who knows how to cry on cue or whatever. And there's no, and often I feel like a lot of times the awards get won. Maybe this isn't true. Maybe this is sort of my imagination, but it feels like awards get won by like, so-and-so was playing a person who was like this, who had like some issue.
Sure, there's always, right. It depends. That was a very good year for American cinema. And I think that we were, was it 2007? Seven. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we were. There Will Be Blood was out around the same time.
Which is a great example of, I think it's like The Wizard of Oz, which was shut out of the Oscars because of Gone with the Wind in the same year.
Right.
Which any other year, it would have just swept.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was a situation like that. Which is, that's crazy when you think about those two films coming out in the same year and kind of, what a wonderful moment for cinema.
Yeah, absolutely.
American cinema. And it follows on the botched invasion of Iraq and all the rest and the anxiety about that and the impending economic crisis and all the rest that time. I think if we can cast our minds back a dozen years, we can remember what that time felt like, the anxiety everyone was feeling, the stress. Yeah. And both of these films are historical films. Even though No Country, this is another thing I really liked about No Country for Old Men, is that it comes out in the aughts. It's a period piece, but it doesn't feel like a period piece somehow.
Yeah.
It exists in this.
It's really, like, you only really know it's a period piece when there are vehicles involved. And even then, not at first, because it's like, well, does Lone Wasp, what year truck would he?
Right.
I mean, is it surprising if you were driving a 40-year-old truck? Not really.
You don't notice it. And it's interesting because had Mad Men taken off at that point? I don't think so.
I feel like it was on.
Maybe it had started. That whole nostalgic thing where the fetishizing of costume and, well, it's a different sort of film for sure, right. But you just don't look at No Country for Old Men and go, oh, that's a period piece set in the 80s.
Right.
It's just sort of there.
Yeah. Well, and there's something about that that's maybe like some commentary on the aesthetics of rural areas anyway, just like, you know, if you went to some rural parts of Texas, would people of a certain age basically look just like that? Probably.
Yeah. Right. I think that's it too. It's as if nothing has changed since then. So that serves as a metaphor of its own when you think about the time and our misadventures. I say our, but the United States misadventures in Iraq and the anxiety about repeating Vietnam.
Right.
That was
right.
very much in play in
sure.
you know, multiple levels there.
No, there's definitely a thing there, and it is interesting that he thinking about it more through the lens of the Vietnam story, you think, okay, so there's the blatant Vietnam touches of like him talking to the Border Patrol agent when he's trying to get back in the United States.
Well, and then he talks to the Woody Harrelson character who is also a vet, and they relate on that. They relate and they don't. It's not like they were buddies who were in Normandy. It's just that uneasy. I can't.
And Woody,
you know.
Yeah. Woody Harrelson says something along the lines of, just because, like, I wish I could remember it exactly, but he says, like, that doesn't make you like me.
That doesn't make you my buddy.
No,
it's vice versa. It's Llewellyn the reverse. That. Llewellyn says that.
Right. Yeah. Are we supposed to be buddies or something?
Yeah. It's so much more in the film than meets the eye.
No, I think that's true. Yeah. And then you realize this is how he knows how to do all of this stuff. It's probably how he knows how to soft that shotgun. And it's probably how he knows, how to hide. I mean, when he hides the money in certain way, like I think it's where he learned a lot of this stuff. And you notice it too. As soon as he comes across these guns, he knows exactly how to handle them. He gets like a semi-automatic gun of some, like a machine gun of some kind, which I wouldn't have any idea what to do with, even if I had it. And he's like immediately like checking to see if it's loaded, and you know, he knows how to handle it.
I had never made the Rambo connection. It's
like a realistic Rambo.
It's kind of
yeah. It's like Rambo doesn't kill 70 people or whatever. He manages to like shoot one guy in the leg. Yeah.
The performance that you get out of Javier Bardem and at the end when he gets hit, T-boned for no reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the randomness of it all. And there's just this look in his eye. And I don't know how they got the shot or what he was thinking or what he wasn't thinking, but he has this look almost, there's almost like an amused look. He looks like, obviously he's in shock, and it's just, this is so perfect. Such a fun film.
That touches on that. I'm glad you said that, because in the book, very early on, you know, when he, in the movie, he escapes from, he's arrested and he escapes.
Yeah.
You know, so he escapes in that great scene of strangling the guy with the handcuffs or whatever. In the book, it says that he allowed himself to be arrested to see if he could escape by an act of will.
Wow.
So yeah, like so that definitely does dovetail to the end, where it's like, oh, here is an interesting challenge that I can see if I can handle.
Right. That's so fascinating. You made a point at the beginning of the podcast, this episode, that it's a case where the film exceeds the book. I don't necessarily want to enter that debate, but it is one of the rare cases where you can say maybe.
I think there's a case to be made, which is I mean, kind of crazy for me, because I think of Cormac McCarthy as sort of, you know, the 90s, 2000s, like, yeah, he's one of the greats. He's on the Mount Rushmore of American letters, in my opinion. So
I don't think it's not a competition. It's just such an interesting thing that such greatness begets more greatness,
right?
And that they pulled it off without fucking the dog.
Right.
Right. They got it right. They got it right. Yeah. They took this source material that should be. So who's going to direct Blood Meridian?
Almost, in my opinion, it's almost like just leave it alone. It should be a TV show. It definitely, if they do it, it's got to be like a one season series for sure. I mean, I don't know who makes it. It's darker than No Country for Old Men by a lot. There's some humor in it. I don't know who could do it.
I'm
kind
of with you. I'm sure that somebody holds the rights to it or something.
Yeah.
I'm
sure James Franco was talking about doing it at one point. I don't have any opinion on his directorial skills. I don't know if I've ever seen a movie he's directed or not. But anyway, I don't know. Could be interesting, I guess. I mean, yeah, I guess I'm not against it. But I don't know how you would do it to improve things.
Sure.
The only person I can think of who could probably pull it off is not making those kinds of movies anymore. It's what is his name? He's the guy who just made the Blade Runner sequel.
Oh, right. Oh, damn. I'm
totally blanking on his name right now.
Let's look it up. Yeah. We still haven't answered the question. What's it about? what's No Country for Old Men about?
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing that I love about it. It's on the surface, it's just a movie about like guns and drugs and crime and shit. You know, like there's like a, like if you were to see it on your DirecTV or whatever menu, what would the description be? Like, I feel like it would just be like, I don't know.
When war veteran Llewellyn Moss stumbles across a drug deal gone bad in the desert, he bites off more than he can chew.
Yeah, it would be something like that. And I'd probably just skip right past it.
Right. Tommy Lee Jones. Oh, I'll watch it. The fellow you were talking about who directed Blade Runner 2049, which I loved.
That was fantastic.
Is Denis Villeneuve.
Yes. He's also making Dune right now.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
What? Like a film or a TV series?
Yeah,
I hope it's a film.
So that'll be interesting. Yeah.
Cool.
And he also made, so the other thing is he made Sicario.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So I don't know if you saw that. Sicario is top notch, in my opinion. So he could do Blood Meridian, probably. I mean, I don't know who you get to act any of those roles.
Ambitious. To pull off. I want to play the dancing bear at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, you just grow a little beard. Have a couple cocktails on the way. And Start eating some more spaghetti.
I'll play the boy and the dancing bear. I really liked Blade Runner 2049. I thought it was fantastic. It got
like the only criticisms people had were that were slow moving, and I was like, well, Jesus Christ.
That criticism means nothing to me. That is a cue for me to run toward the film.
Right.
Have you seen Barry Lyndon? Yeah. It was pretty slow.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Indeed.
Yeah, I suppose there are, like, I do think that slowness has to be earned to a certain extent, though, right?
Sure.
Yeah, but you're right. Like, that is not, to me, that is not a valid criticism. So, right. Yeah.
May I mention something that I saw recently? I saw the Kubrick exhibition at the Design Museum over in London, and that's on until September, and it was amazing. If you I don't know how these things work, but if it's like anything, sort of in this world, they typically move these things around because it's a lot to put these exhibitions together.
Yeah, and they gotta make their money back.
Well. Yeah. Right.
And they want people to see it.
I think so. You get the impression, and sure, there's plenty of money to be made here.
Yeah.
But it was wow. And if you get a chance to see it, if it comes over to New York or wherever it would go here, I presume New York. Wow. Really check it out. They had it was immersive in a sense. You know, you walked onto this carpet and it was the carpet from The Shining. And that's how you start, and all these little touches and these notes, and they had the typewriter from The Shining there.
Nice.
They had the masks. From Eyes Wide Shut. All of these props and these objects and the statues from the Moloko milk bar from...
Oh, no shit.
They had the big dick. They had the murder weapon.
That's hilarious. You know, I kind of... I remember at one point a few years ago wondering what happened to those statues. Just... Yeah.
What are they going to do? They're art objects. Yeah. You have to hold on to those fucking things.
Right, right. Yeah, you don't just toss them out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But they also, like, who would actually have them as furniture in their house? You know what I mean? Like, I would love to have one because that would be a crazy thing to have, but I probably would not display it. It would be in my garage under a tarp. And, yeah.
It was wild because... I'm very fond of Jocelyn Pook, who's the musician who he tapped. You know about this because we're old buddies, but he what does that make you, my buddy? We were nom together, Brad. But this is crazy. I don't think I've told you this story. Maybe I have, but I love her music. And obviously I got turned on to it because of Kubrick. He used two of her tracks from her sort of original first album. I don't even know if it was an album before he used the tracks, and she was writing music for theater, and it's fantastic. And if you have seen Eyes Wide Shut, I know it's a little slow, but if you've seen Eyes Wide Shut, and if you haven't, you should. Yeah. The famous scene with the chanting and the right before the orgy, and then the orgy itself, he used two of her tracks. Mm. And I can't imagine what it would be like to have Kubrick...
Oh, God.
Pull your music for his film, his final film. Incredible.
Yeah.
And so she's made a career as a person who scores for film and television. She scored.
Had she scored anything before that?
Theater.
Okay. Okay.
Theater and opera and stuff, if I'm not mistaken. I think she's Canadian originally. I should know more because there was a long time where I listened to those albums every week. And I wrote the one play listening to her follow-up album almost exclusively. It was like the soundtrack for this play. So big fan. Didn't know that they performed. I mean, you know, that she's just kind of like, she's online, but she's not like posting on Instagram every day.
Right.
She's not Cardi B.
Right.
So anyway, so I'm going through the Kubrick exhibition and I'm coming out and I start hearing this music and there's chanting and there's music and there's like a drum track, electro track in the back, and I'm like looking around, that's Jocelyn Pook's music. That's Jocelyn Pook. And I walk out and it's Jocelyn Pook and her ensemble warming up.
No shit.
Yes, shit.
That's awesome, man.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
It was so cool. And so I got to see them warm up, and that just meant the world to me. It was it was a synchronicity without a doubt.
And
that's
awesome.
Now that I know that they're out there performing, I'm going to hunt them down.
Well, I'm sure you could. I'm sure at some point you can see them in New York. I mean, you know.
Think, but they're not. It's not like, because I was over there to see Dead Can Dance and I saw them the next night. It's not a band like that.
Although, right. They're not playing like a bar and
they're not playing theaters. They're not. It's not that kind of group. Yeah. But and yet. I hope that it's a little more elevated. It's sort of somewhere between like a chamber orchestra and it's a weird ensemble too. I mean, she's got this lead, you know, this vocalist who's this, I think Indian fellow, and he sings, I think in Hindi, and it's just this whole, anyway, man, it was such a great experience.
That sounds really
and
cool.
If you get a chance to see the Kubrick exhibition, I mean,
I would totally go see that if that comes around for sure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just it's really a destination kind of thing. And you know who it was, my buddy, shout out to Fraser Brown, my buddy over in London, who was like,
right on.
All right, man, you gotta do that. When I was over there, I love that town because the bus I was taking would go over Abbey Road. Like it was nothing. And occasionally the bus would just slow down and in the middle of the day, you'd be like, what's going on with, they're all taking the picture.
A million people taking that one picture. Yeah.
Useless.
Yeah.
Get out of the road. Why don't we do it in the road? That was the White Album, right?
Right.
Different album.
Yeah.
Well, we got another 10 minutes, Brad Kelly. Let's meditate briefly on No Country for Old Men and stay on topic, I think.
I found the criticisms of the movie interesting. And I, you know, the one major criticism I heard of the movie was at the end, it just didn't make any sense. That the ending was stupid. Not only the moment with Anton Chigurh when he gets T-boned and then sort of walks off with a broken arm and sort of disappears back into the environment because he's sort of a creature and not a man in some ways. So he's like, but it's like the creature of the Black Lagoon going back into the Black Lagoon in some ways. But then you have Ed Tom Bell, who is retired, and the last moment, the last bits of dialogue of the film are him describing a dream, and then it ends.
Right, right.
And people hated that. Like, a lot of people hated it. And I get goosebumps during that scene. I think it's incredibly powerful. You know, not only Tommy Lee Jones's performance, but just the archetypal nature of the dream as described, without being cliched or cheesy in any way.
It's not on the nose whatsoever. It's about him going to see his father, isn't it?
Yeah, and then in some moment, you know, his father carries on past him with like a horn of fire, like a little horn where he's carrying embers, and they're out riding on horses back in the old days. And his father just keeps going, you know.
Yeah,
it's not a— sorry, those are dogs going— these dogs going crazy.
Don't apologize for life.
Yeah,
they're hound dogs. It's all right.
They bark at everything.
Oh, just, shit.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, but that dream moment is beautiful, and like, I'm really interested in how anything dream related in a piece of art, film, or book is, I think, challenging, and I think can be really bad. And
well, the cliche would be, and this was all a dream.
Of course.
Chigurh was right.
You can't do that. But it was so— him describing that dream was incredibly compelling to me.
You get the impression at the end, that last performance, that might be the first time he's told his wife one of his dreams in a hell of a long time. He's got time to sit and think about his dream now that he's retired.
Yeah, she literally says that to him, you know.
What does she say?
He says, she asked him how he slept, because it's like one of his first days actually retired. And she asks him how he slept, and he says, "I don't know, I had dreams." And she says, "Well, you got time for him now."
Right.
Anything interesting?
Right.
And he says, "Well, there always is to the party concerned." You know, he kind of rebuffs her when she asks about it. And then he finally goes into it.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. A dream is only interesting if you're in it, is what
kind
people
of
say.
That's what they say. I am 50-50 on that. I mean, I'm sort of biased. I mean, I'm writing a book that has got a lot of dream stuff in it. So I'm sort of realizing how easily it can veer into cheesiness.
You have to be sensitive.
Yeah, you got to be very— it's like working with I don't know, if you were a painter and you had some very delicate pigment, you know, you normally you're swabbing away with oils or whatever, and then you got this one pigment that if you don't handle it just right, it'll fall away.
It'll fuck up the other canvas on fire or something.
Yeah, that's kind of what it feels like a little bit. And you're like, oh, got to be careful with this.
I'll tend to agree there. The other thing that I saw when I was over there was the Freud Museum.
Oh,
I went to the Freud Museum.
He spent
the last 2 years of his life roughly in London in exile from the Nazis. And he had recreated his room. I mean, this is germane, right? We're talking about dreams.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And his room was exactly what you would expect. It was just almost like a theater.
In the sense that
you were coming to see the wise old man, and he was going to help you help yourself and everything. And all of the— we will get back to